welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Hagman and Hagman Report on this Monday, January 4th, 2016. We want to make a few announcements here. We did get an email. I want to thank Scott S. He sent us the information on the bookstore in Tupper Lake. It's called The Tattered Cover, along with the address and phone number.
Hey, we have to, you know what? We got to call that bookstore and see if we can get an inventory list. Or, hey, if anyone lives in Tupper Lake listening to this, if you want to drop in there and help us out, we'll pay the shipping on and the purchase for the books. There's the number
even
that we're
looking
for.
Buy you some books.
Yeah, right on.
Does the shopping. Also, want to say thanks and a Merry Christmas to Julia, Barney, and Cookie. Like these Christmas cards. I know you.
Oh yeah,
have a that's
gonna
bulletin board.
Going to go up on our board.
And also want to thank Lori from. Make sure I get this right here. Lori from. Where are you from here? You are in British Columbia, Vancouver Island, British Columbia. And she says this, that she's listens to the show every morning the next day. Loves Steve Quayle. He's a favorite guest. Because he gets angry at the sin and behavior of the world. And she shares the same opinion. Yeah, so thanks, Lori.
God bless you.
We do read the mail. And
postal mail. It came in by postal mail, of course.
Lots of cards and lots of notes. And also lots of bumper sticker requests. Folks, if you
I gotta tell you, old man, do some extra work.
Yeah. Send an email request. And
what we need, though, okay, so here's a couple of issues, all right? We're behind on this. We promise. I know that people have said, oh, where in the world are they? What are you making them? Are you pan-painting them? You know, come on. Okay, so we're getting them out, but please include your name. We've had them come back, and it's postage. You know, we don't charge for bumper stickers, but postage, we don't charge for anything. So, but if you don't include your real name, your address, and, you know, your full postal address, it doesn't get delivered sometimes. So please include that. And before you get back to the show, folks, I want to just talk about, the website nuts.com. We found this incredible website. Once you get that name in your head, you won't get it out of your head. Nuts.com, they have, in our opinion, the best tasting nuts, dried fruits, snacks on the planet. Nuts.com is a simple, very convenient way to have nutritious, delicious, healthy, and so many other tasty treats from around the world delivered right to your door. And that's cool. It goes right to your door. Our experience in ordering from Nuts.com, it's simple, seamless. It's easy. The only hard part about it is choosing, oh, what we'd like. And I'll tell you something. We could order one of everything. But, folks, right now, if you go to nuts.com or go to hagmanhagman.com, click on the icon, the logo for Nuts, or just go to nuts.com, and in the microphone box, this is key, put in HH. You'll see when you go there. You'll know you did everything right when you see extra special offer. Hello there, Hagman and the Hagman listener. Choose your four free gifts on this page. Add $25 worth of other goodies to your cart and place your order. These 2 to 3 ounce packs will tickle your taste buds, and they've got roasted cashews and pistachios and, oh my goodness, dried apricots and jumbo dates, organic trail mix. I mean, they've got everything. How about chocolate, dark chocolate covered espresso beans? A few of those before the show, and we'll be able to see right back through you. Just so much there, folks. Right now, go to nuts.com, click on the mic, enter our code HH. You know, this is a family-owned business since 1929. They have prided themselves on delivering the best in nuts and dried fruit that you'll find anywhere on the planet. I agree. Our favorites, I've mentioned them to you. The dried fruit, any sweet treat there. The sugar and gluten-free items they have. They also have coffees and teas and other gifts. Nuts.com. So right now, folks, you get four free samples by going to nuts.com, entering HH in the microphone box, and bada bing, you are in for a treat. And it's so fun to get. It's so fun to give as well. It's just, it's really great. So, nuts.com, microphone code HH Joe. Before the break, we were talking about, of course, what? We were talking about the standoff, or the Oregon standoff. And Alex Jones, InfoWars, he's got an article by Paul Joseph Watson. Oregon standoff could boost Obama's gun control push. Folks, we don't live in a simple world. We live in a complex world where the agendas are hidden and they are conflicting. You might look at a situation and think, oh, that's what it's all about. But you take a couple of steps to the left or to the right, you see things a little bit differently. And when you do a complete 360 all around a situation, you can see where there are different agendas pulling at one another. And everything is not what it appears. Now, again, while the concept is correct, you've got to ask yourself, okay, is the motivation, what's motivating this? And is there, is this really the time, the place, and the people with which we want to make a stand? Or is this something a little bit deeper? Perhaps, well, some are concerned that the standoff there could be an ill-conceived move that's only going to serve to bolster Obama's gun control agenda as he prepares to unveil new executive orders or executive actions to restrict firearms. Folks, it's going to happen this week. I'm going to tell you right now, this is the bottom line agenda. This is the plan, and they are coming after your guns. They're coming after you. And I'm going to tell you, as Stuart Rhodes had said, if you read his piece about the situation in Oregon, at least the initial piece that he had back on the 1st of January, you've got to understand what's really taking place here. You've got to understand that the ultimate objective here, and I'm going to turn this, we're going to get into the economists and such, but this is so important to really understand what's taking place. The statement about universal background checks, that's code, folks. That is code for a gun registry, national gun registry. And you might think, how could that possibly be? But if you look at the devil in the details, you'll understand that they will be making a national gun registry. Over the weekend, I interviewed a man, the owner of a gun store, who said this is what they're going for. And he knows this because he's been in business for well over 20 years. He's seen many changes, and now he can understand and anticipate the changes that are going to be taking place in our state, which will affect all of the states through the executive orders. Bottom line here is they are going to use, now, and I'm going to reference Stuart Rhodes's piece here. But this is what it's all about. This is the end game objective, and it should not be ignored, okay? This goes well beyond the Bundy and Hammond, the family there. Let me pull it down here. You know, thank you, emailer, Judy. She writes, I just don't want to see another Ruby Ridge, nor do we. Nor do we. You know, that's right.
And when you think about the situation, as you went over, how the there is a disconnect from, you know, what is happening versus what the actual victims of this situation, the two people who serve the jail sentence and have to go back, what they want.
That's right.
Versus what the militia, quote-unquote militia, wants versus what, I mean, I don't know, what Mr. Bundy wants.
There's a bifurcated agenda here.
Who knows? You hear two different stories coming out of the same group of people.
Well, I'll just reference what Stuart Rhodes wrote, and then you kind of get an idea where this is all going. And then we'll move to The Economist and show you where it is in The Economist. He writes this: all of you who are impatient and itching for a fight, put your thinking caps on. Use your heads. And we do have, in right now, and I've seen this up close and personal, we have a whole lot of people who hear something, they see a situation They look at a situation, they immediately, there's a knee-jerk reaction, they need to comment on it without thinking, and they look at only the surface, they don't look underneath the surface, they don't start, they don't peel back, you know, the levels of different biases and agendas, and they get themselves in trouble. But he says, keep your cool, and don't worry, the fight is going to come to you soon enough. Obama and the anti and the other anti-gun idiot politicians, such as the governor of Connecticut, they're not going to be able to resist the temptation to attempt to violate our right to bear arms by executive decree, such as barring anyone to put on the no-fly list and other, quote, government watch lists, end quote, from owning guns, which would include him, the writer, Stuart Rose, by the way, and include all of us, as he is on an aviation security watch list. So he gets the boarding pass with the SSSSS on top, right? Which signifies that he needs to be thoroughly screened. It's the grope-a-dope kind of situation. He writes, I can't even check in and get a boarding pass from the ticket agent without the airlines calling DHS for permission to let me fly. But here is the bottom line, okay? The intent is to eventually put all of you, if you're listening to this program, and if you are agreeing with what we're saying, and if you understand the big picture, every one of you is going to be on a list. They are going to eventually put all of you on danger or on a list. You're dangerous. If you're a veteran, if you're a patriot, if you're a constitutionalist, if you believe in the traditional family and speak out against the queer homosexual family agenda, if you believe in anti or pro-life, I should say, you're all going to be labeled. You're going to be put on the list. And see, they're going to designate you by that list as dangerous, and therefore you will be barred from owning guns.
If you're lucky, right.
Because
they're eliminated.
They're going to use that to disarm you, right? One at a time. And actually, they actually think we're just going to roll over and let them do just that. Now, some of the Christians who have a perverse, in my view, have a perverse idea of Romans 13 will say, okay, go ahead. Remember, welcome back, Carter. Go ahead.
Well, you're going to like Brzezinski. So.
Well, yeah, we'll
get
to that.
He does break this down pretty good.
So anyway, you are seeing now the incremental steps, and we told you before the holiday, and we're telling you right now what's the next thing that comes out of Obama's mouth coming after your guns, but he's doing it in a backhanded way. And do you think for one moment this spineless, the 535 primarily spineless politicians inside the Beltway are going to do anything about it, or the nine rogue robed black robed rogue judges, do you think they're going to do anything about it? No. They're coming after you, and the squeeze is on in 2016. And let me just refer to the, and I'm going to push it right to you after this. Remember the symbolism in The Economist. And Eric, you can put up the calendar page. You see, it's not just the cover. The cover represents, all of these pictures are really contained between the covers of this magazine.
Yeah, you thought okay. I was looking at this while you were talking about the cover and...
Right. So what they've got is a 2016 calendar, folks, in right here.
Right, which they talk about different events, historical and or in the future, like the this month, for example, is the Davos Economic Forum in Davos, the G20?
It doesn't matter.
It's one of those groups.
But take a look over, if you're watching this live on YouTube, you can take a look over at, and I may be writing a report on this, so on the screen, you might have to take the picture-in-picture out, because I think you're covered, yeah.
The two things that caught my eye, one is the blackened-out sun.
Right.
And the second thing is, if you see at the top, everything below seems to be underground.
Well, it's in a stadium, basically.
Okay. Well, you may see people on the right in a cemetery.
Right, but I guess in the context of the Bundy or the Oregon Ranch deal, folks, if you look on the right-hand side, the very right-hand side of the picture, you're going to see Go National Parks. And by the way, this is a photograph of the magazine, okay? So you're going to see Go National Parks. And look to your left of that. What do you see? You see basically a ranch or a cabin kind of house ablaze. And underneath Go National Parks, you see tanks entering in this exit, no exit portion of this mock stadium. And if you look at Go National Parks, you see an army of warriors with bows and arrows, with the bows at the ready. You see some deer and such, cartoonish things, but one of the animals holding up Go National Parks. Mm-hmm. Well, part of that is Bureau of Land Management, and of course, what does that mean? Right next to it there, especially the style of that house, if you will, that is ablaze. Doesn't that signify to the casual observer, perhaps, that something will take place that will cause this conflagration that may or may not involve the national parks?
And separate from that is a fire right above on the left. That's the Burning Man festival.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the house.
Right, but nonetheless, I guess what I'm saying is, isn't it interesting the timing of this? And are we seeing, perhaps, are we not seeing prophecy or their calendar come into play with respect to the Bundy Ranch? Is it possible that it has nothing to do with it? Absolutely, it's possible. It's just my read into the situation, especially given the fact that they have admitted to using symbolism to convey their agenda. Is it their agenda to take out to use this particular situation, the Oregon standoff? I believe, folks, that this is the catalyst that will result in a violent showdown between the federal authorities and the protesters who have vowed to defend themselves with force. And this is going to give Obama the moral high ground, the perfect narrative to exploit to justify, as Paul Joseph Watson states, draconian new measures on gun ownership. They are playing directly into the hands of the people who are making the rules, and we're seeing it take place right now, and we're stepping all over ourselves because everybody has to have their own agenda. They all have to do what they think is right. No one is looking at the big picture, and I don't care if you're talking about this subject or any subject where there's divisiveness and dissension. No one's looking at the big picture. But in this case, please look at the bigger picture. Look at the fact that provocation in this case appears to be. And Oath Keepers had called it in the beginning, the Hammond family, which is at the center of this dispute, has insisted that it is not affiliated with a group that's occupying the wildlife refugee building. So what's that all about? It's a bunch of people with an agenda that is not consistent with the freedom movement, with the people who are concerned about the Second Amendment and the constitutional right to bear arms.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. Don't get played. Don't be gamed. Don't give a knee-jerk reaction to something. Understand what's going on. On the other hand, don't demonize these people quickly, okay? You got to wait until, let's sort it out, okay? You got to sort it out. You got to do the investigation. But it looks to me right now,
you get 99% of the people there with good intentions, at least, from what we can gather.
But they're victimized because they're being played.
Exactly. So, I mean, unless there's a reason, you're called to be out there for someone specific who's out there, who lives out there, called you to be out there. Don't just go for fun. I mean, all the things that you're seeing here, like you said, it's a recipe for a disaster that
Indeed.
Can be planned to happen. And what better way to really strike the heart of, you know, Gun Owner USA by saying, look, a militia turned violent, went on the offensive against the federal government. You can see how many different ways this can unfold for a bad ending.
Oh, and it will. Well, regardless whether it ends in violence or ends in arrest, or it's going to have a bad ending. And because again, this is the wrong place, the wrong time, the wrong people, the wrong fight, the wrong motives, the wrong everything's wrong about this. And it's just so just kind of understand this. And Steve Quayle's source indicated this on his Q alerts. I got this separately. In fact, Dave Hodges got this separately when I was on the Common Sense Show last night. So look at the bigger picture. Don't get played. Don't be a fool. Try not to be a fool. I mean, look, we all do stuff, right? That you know, we sit there and we see something and we automatically react to it, whether it's sending an email or talking to a friend or whatever. We react to it, and it's without knowing the entire story. In fact, I would venture to guess a lot of people are weighing in on this, and I've seen a lot of people weigh in on this on both Democratic and Republican forums, political forums, who don't have a clue what the backstory is. A clue. Not a clue. So, you know, there's always more to the story than you think you know. So be very careful. Now, I'm going to turn it over to Joe. Are you ready to talk about what you want to talk about here?
Well, yeah. I have one article that we'll get to after...
Because
I mean, this is a good segue for one part of this book.
Go ahead. Go ahead, because your research is extremely important, which you've done with Zbigniew Brzezinski and his book. What's the name of the book?
Totalitarian Dictatorship and Autocracy.
Okay, and that was published, I think, in 1970, correct?
The first copy was in the first edition was in 1955.
Okay.
He wrote this with another gentleman by the name of Frederick, and I don't have the first name here.
All right.
Yeah, well, 55 was the first edition of this book, which is April 1956.
Remember, Brzezinski is the guy who's the foreign policy guy behind Obama, and the domestic policy advisor as well.
Head of the Trilateral Commission, started the Trilateral Commission.
Yep.
Definitely an elite and a revolutionary in the political arena, and has vast influence. His own daughter is the host of the MSNBC show Morning Joe by default, I think. Just trying to find a place for her to have a job. But he goes through other regimes, from Russia to China to Hitler's Germany, and gives general characteristics and then in-depth information into totalitarian, authoritarian, oppressive type governments.
Okay.
And one would think, you know, we think of the more obvious ones like Mao's China or Lenin in Russia, where they have a socialist or fascist type system and the people were behind it. You know, but there are some interesting finds in here, especially when it gets into the Constitution, when it talks about, I mean, very in depth, like I said. And the reason I picked this book back up was mentioning something about the communications about a week ago, 2 weeks ago.
All right. That? Yep.
And in chapter 11 of the book, it's titled Propaganda and the Monopoly of Mass Communications. He says, in a totalitarian dictatorship is created by two closely related phenomena, propaganda and terror.
A totalitarian dictatorship, because this is basically what we have and where we're headed, based in fascism, which relates to our discussions, multiple discussions about the Nazis. And I know every time I mention that, I know I'm getting inside a few people out there. I'm getting inside your head. I love that rental. Thank you for allowing me in there. Okay, now speak, you know who I'm speaking to, but folks, look, this is all based in the Nazi occult agenda and forward, the totalitarian dictatorship that is being discussed. Yes.
Back into the Bible. And we'll get into that later if we have time, but the characteristics of this totalitarian system is so evident in our society today. I was surprised when I went back and read this, even more so than a few years back when I read this book. But they go on to say that when it pertains to monopoly of the mass communications and propaganda, that the terror and propaganda are two closely related forces or phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And the atmosphere it creates is a general sense of insecurity, fear, of terror from the victims of terror are quite unaware of their own psychic states. Terror reinforces the monopoly. Although mass communications is a good part of all communication, totalitarian propaganda can be understood only with this context, and conversely, the terror assumes its all-pervading quality because it is spread about through the continuous repetition of official propaganda lines. Now, where this pertains to the media, it states in here that one of the characteristics, most striking characteristics of a totalitarian dictatorship is the feature which differentiates itself from earlier forms of autocratic rule, which is the complete monopoly of mass communications. In totalitarian dictatorships, all the means of communications are centrally controlled by the government, regardless of whether they are actually owned by the government, as in the Soviet Union, or under a private ownership, as in the fascist countries. The monopoly of the channels of mass communication is reinforced by the control of the means of private communication. The postal service, and more especially the telephone and telegraph, wiretapping is a common practice, and there is, of course, no such thing as privacy in the mails. In the interest of combating counter-revolutionary plots, the government claims the right to open all mail, which means only word-of-mouth communication is left for those who wish to carry opposition beyond the point permitted by the government. But getting into the more important issues, the propaganda is coincides with the totalitarian or oppressive dictatorships, and sometimes we see it more subtly, sometimes we see it more vehemently. It's always aimed at the people. The propaganda today is so subtle and complex because we have so many outlets to which they can use, whether it be print, radio, TV, even just visual aids on a teleprompter or a screen in random places, like you see the TSA see something, say something ads. But in totalitarian dictatorships, propaganda is directed ultimately to the maintenance of power in the party who controls it. Getting into the future here, and the church, I wanted to hit this before we hit anything else. The totalitarian is a system of revolution. It seeks to destroy the existing political order. Such dictatorships, after seizing power, have usually devoted their energies in the preservation of the existing order without upsetting any fundamental changes. And when this change did occur, as a result, there is more often a spite of efforts of the dictator to back off, to make it look like they did not seize power. There was no change of leadership or of power. They get into the elections and selections and the differences and how those are controlled and how they've been controlled throughout history, and they get into social schemes and reconstructions. But this is where I thought it was very interesting and pertains to our audience. It says that the constitutional republics of throughout history turn into a democracy, which is the same as a totalitarian system, because the president is the end all and has the ability to make laws, make changes, say yes or no to laws, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And we live in a constitutional republic, which is supposed to have equal representation.
Balanced, or checks and balances.
Correct. But throughout the history of our nation, we've had, you know, people who say the Constitution's a living document and it can be changed. You see it with the Second Amendment arguments today. In a free society, total change cannot occur because it would bring forth a massive resistance. In a society, opposition is prevented from developing by the organization of terror. Yet total change remains a utopian goal. This is what we're seeing today, this push towards a utopian goal, a collective society. They say that the destruction of the existing society will have to be indeed total. Violence that leads to terror is almost inevitable with this concept. It is impossible to subject one social group to punitive, or as totalitarians would call it, re-educative measures without producing a hostile reaction.
Well, we are being manipulated through terrorism and through the prospect of terrorism, whether it be domestic or otherwise, and whether it be the fear of these militia groups or ISIS. Go ahead.
Goes on to say, this system, because of the alleged ideological infallibility of its dogma, is continually tempted to increase the terror by violent passion for the anonymity. Since history tells the totalitarian he is right, he expects all others to agree with him. The passion makes the totalitarians insist on the assent of the entire population to the regime's outlook and activities. We see this in our government and administration today. First, at eliminating their open enemies, are gradually disappeared from sections of society. Totalitarian terror grows until it reaches a limit where it becomes self-defeating. And it goes through many different examples. But this is where I really found interesting. Any dissent will be stamped out or liquidated. There will be no resistance when this is actually in place for real. And the church's role is what is really important. You know, they talk about the labor camps, the forced collectivization, which is what I'm going to get into next, because this is right around the corner. It's also in The Economist magazine, which I didn't see until we started the show. But this is where it's interesting, where Mr. Brzezinski talks about the churches. And this deals with what you were talking about, dealing with our role in resisting the oppressive regime while staying in the biblical context and laws.
And they are not mutually exclusive. One can do both. Okay, so you can be biblically correct, and in fact, biblically righteous.
Yeah.
And fight.
Yeah, and I'm going to read this part about the church, and I'm just going to give out the six characteristics of the totalitarian
regime.
Okay,
you know what? I'll tell you what, Eric. Why don't you pop on the calendar that we took a photograph of from the world in 2016 on the video aspect, if you're watching by video. And folks, look at this as Joe goes through this, because these are deeply connected. Okay? Deeply connected. And there we have it. It's just and you can entertain yourself by looking at that and picking out the different parts as Joe goes through what he's going to go through. Go ahead.
Yeah, and there is a interesting write-up here from a pastor in 1942 directed at the Nazis from a church who didn't act until it was too late. But in conclusion, this is what they say about the churches, and we'll go back to that.
Address that if you want, because I think that's important.
Okay, they say, go back to the beginning of this paragraph. As a matter of fact, Hitler had plunged Germany into a war. The Catholic hierarchy and the confessional church was confronted with a difficult problem. They did not wish to be unpatriotic but seemingly hostile to the fatherland, yet the intensification of totalitarian trends under the impact of war necessitated a sharper rejection of Hitler and his movements. Among the most moving documents portrayed this conflict are the sermons of Bishop Galen after the bombardment and destruction of Munster. Virtually from amidst the rubble, the staunch anti-Nazi denounced the tyranny of the Gestapo. In one of his sermons, he said the right to life, to inviolability, and to liberty are indispensable part of every moral social order. Any state which oversteps these limits imposed by God and which permits or causes the punishment of innocent men undermines its own authority and the respect for its dignity. And it goes on
that according to the church
documents. That's not in the letter here, yeah. German bishops protect against each and every violation of personal freedom. We are concerned not only with religious and church rights, but the God-given rights of all men. And this here, it says, it all culminated in a protest by the entire episcopate meeting in Fluda on March 22nd, 1942. For years, a war has raged in our fatherland against Christianity and the church. We emphasize that we stand up not only for the religious and clerical rights, but likewise for the human rights bestowed by God on mankind. We demand legal evidence for all sentences and the release of all fellow citizens who have been deprived of their liberty without such evidence. The Nazis wish to destroy Christianity if possible. Before the soldiers whose Christian faith gives them the strength for heroic battles and sacrifices return home, we call upon you to support our efforts decisively and firmly. We refuse the suggestion that we should prove our patriotic faith through faithlessness towards Christ and His church. We remain eternally true to our fatherland just because, and at any price, we remain true to our Savior and our church. God bless our country and our church. God grant honest, happy, lasting peace to the church and the fatherland. This speech was aimed at the Nazis for the killing of unproductive persons, which struck a chord with the some of the pastors. And if you guys remember, the Catholic Church actually endorsed Hitler in some of the worst of the times. The Italian Church and Catholic Church partnered up with Hitler. But here, this is what Brzezinski writes, and I was kind of taken back by this. In conclusion, we can say that the Christian churches have shown themselves to be a real bulwark against the claim to total power of the totalitarian dictatorship, more than any other. Whether Protestant or Catholic, the genuine Christian cannot accept totalitarianism, for Christianity claims the whole man and the last word with regard to man's values and his destiny. This claim the totalitarians cannot accept. They may temporarily seek to compromise, but if they accept this claim, they would cease to be totalitarians. This is what has happened in Spain. It is a gradual retreat from totalitarianism to a personal and military dictatorship. Franco's regime had the steady support of the Catholic clergy. Its highly conservative inclination at the same time made it resist all popular democratic tendencies. Now that's going back to the example of the Pope.
That's right.
But this may not mean that the people are prepared to accept a secular religion of a totalitarian kind. Perhaps family will prove to be a comparable bulwark of human dignity, though the evidence so far is rather discouraging. Now remember, this is written in 1955.
And it's written by Brzezinski and his partner in crime. Gotta consider the context, especially after World War II. Go ahead.
And this chapter ends with this. By contrast, the islands of separation represented by the Christian churches as guardians of the individual conscience and its religious freedom are likely to outlast even a long-term totalitarian dictatorship. The extent to which they still exist in genuine form in the Soviet Union is rather uncertain, but the catacombs of the unknown religious underground, the spirit of a Christian may be reborn. And he ends with that. But he also outlines this in other parts of the book when dealing and talking about Christianity. And it's the only religion that he singles out and states that you cannot have a oppressive government and have a Christian population that would compromise to their demands. Any compromise would mean that the people who are compromising never had a belief system or didn't believe enough to for it to be true, where they used it as a well, he explains it in here as you know, it's a belief until action's put behind it, and if there's no action put behind it, it was never an important enough belief. And we can understand that as we see.
Well, and if I can just add something in here, you know, when we you've got to go back in history, and ladies and gentlemen, Joe in his research found something extremely important, and this was published, and we're going over this document right now. A lot of things right now are being made public that have been previously declassified and previously released by the CIA, and one of the declassifications is a draft working paper titled Eagle and Swastika, CIA and Nazi War Criminals and Collaborators,
yeah,
by Kevin Ruffner. Okay.
This is what I was saying earlier, the Vichy archives. Are you familiar with
yes,
them?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, France opens classified Vichy archives to the public. That
Vichy
was
French, right?
On the 29th of December.
Of December. Now, you've got to ask yourself, okay, why now, why in this time period are we seeing the declassification, not the declassification, because that has been done previous, but why now are we seeing the publication of the long previously declassified documents relating to Hitler, the Nazis?
Yeah, I mean, there is a
why.
Lot.
Why?
Now, I'm even seeing.
And again, I people say, "Well, you're obsessed with the Nazis." No, I'm obsessed with the time in which we live and how it compares to pre-war Germany, and how all of the Nazis, the Nazi agenda, going back to Dulles, going back to the others involved in the sinister forces.
The titans of business and American manufacturing and
there you go.
Economy.
Yes.
Behind, and some to the point where their businesses or banks were shut down, and then they went on to have grandchildren and children that were presidents.
Well, right now we are seeing, I mean, if you look at the experience of the Church in Nazi Germany, it reminds us, of course, that Jesus really must always stand alone. He must be worshipped not as one who stands alongside the governmental leaders of this world, but as standing above them as King of Kings and Lords of Lords. Now, the reason I brought that up is the context in which we discuss these matters. When we think of Nazi Germany, for example, what do we think of when we say Nazi Germany? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? It's, of course, the Holocaust, the brutal murder of millions of Jews and other undesirables that include the blacks and Christians and so on. But we
first thing I thought was a swastika for some reason.
Well, you know, that too, which is, what does that represent? That's a symbol, okay?
Right, which has predated Nazism by thousands of years as a symbol.
Right, and if you cite, for example, the you've got to go back in time. Many of the, well, I would venture to say most, if not all, of the survivors of the Holocaust are have since passed away, but Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor, wrote, "The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis like to say, of blood and soil." And he writes, "I'm absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other of Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers." Stop right there. Because that, what we're seeing here in a good portion of this magazine, addresses the scientists and nihilist scientists and philosophers as they deal with, and you see this on Drudge,
the humanoid.
Yes, humanoids, and living until you're 500 and downloading or uploading your consciousness, folks, understand. And in fact, on the cover, which you can see right now on YouTube, on the cover, there is a compilation. It's actually a composite of three images, right next to the price sticker. It's got a bowl of, we'll say Chinese food with a Chinese flag in it. To the right of that is a man holding
spaceship.
A briefcase, right, covered by a spaceship. And then to the right of that is a jar of brains. The bottom line here is, all of this is being tied together. 2016 is the year that we are going to see all of the, well, not all, but a large jump from the theoretical into the practical. We are seeing it happen, and by 2040, that's their goal, or 2030, by the, I think 2030 is their goal, given agenda, revamping of Agenda 21. But what we're going to see, folks, is this leap toward immortality, apotheosis. Everyone can be like God, small g.
Oh,
and
yeah,
this is the way that it is taking place. And they're using the Nazi technology, and they're using the very intellectual property.
And we're going to get into that right now. The final thing from this Brzezinski book, the six characteristics of a totalitarian dictatorship or regime. One, an elaborate ideology. The official body of doctrine will cover vital aspects of man's existence to which everyone living in that society is supposed to adhere, at least passively, to this ideology is characteristically focused and projected towards a perfect final state of mankind. Remember that, because that is where we are now. Two, a single mass party typically led by one man, a dictator, consisting of a relatively small percentage of total population.
Yep.
It goes through the increased bureaucratization and the oligarchy organized from already a position of power inside the government. Three, a system of terror, whether physical or psychological, affected through party and secret police control, listing enemies of the regime against more or less arbitrarily selected classes of the population, party-directed social pressure.
Okay, wait, stop right there, because that's an important point. Okay, when we get in, what you just is, go ahead and say that again. Read that again.
A system of terror. Is that where it was? The system of terror.
Yeah, whether go ahead. Yes.
Physically yes. or psychologically affected through party and secret police control, characteristically directed only against the demonstrable enemies of the regime, but against more or less the arbitrarily selected classes of the population.
Okay.
Terror, whether of the secret police or party-directed social pressure, systematically exploits modern science and more specifically scientific psychology.
Okay. Now hold that thought for a second, because a key individual, if you look back in history, involved in behavior modification was psychologist Kurt Lewin, L-E-W-I-N. Now, this we're talking about the same time as Brzezinski wrote that book. Now, Lewin was the father of group dynamics, and he was he began his career at Cornell. He worked on a systematic series of studies of the effect of social pressures and the eating habits of children. He immigrated into the United States in 1933. He was a refugee from where? Guess where? Nazi Germany. And like many other German intellectuals, he was forced out of Germany, not because of any basic political differences, but as a sacrifice to Hitler's divide and conquer anti-Semitism. See, okay, now you got that, but what you said there, okay, he wrote a book called Time, Perspective, and Morale, and this, he talked about psychological warfare. Think about what Joe just said. Lewin writes this, one of the main techniques for breaking morale through a strategy of terror consists in exactly this tactic. Keep the person hazy as to where he stands and just what he might expect. If in addition, frequent vacillations between severe disciplinary measures and promises of good treatment together with spreading of contradictory news make the cognitive structure of this situation utterly unclear, then the individual may cease to even know when a particular plan would lead toward or away from his goal. Under these conditions, even those who have definite goals and are ready to take risk will be paralyzed by severe inner conflicts in regard to what to do. And therein lies the one of the crystal nuggets, the golden nuggets of Zbigniew Brzezinski, as he talks about in his 1955 publication. And as represented today in being exploited by the 2016 cover of The Economist inside the pages.
Number four, a technologically conditioned near complete monopoly of control in the hands of the party and the government of all means of effective mass communications, press, radio, motion pictures. That's complete here. Five, a similarly technologically conditioned near complete monopoly of effective use of all weapons of armed combat. Six, a central control and direction of the entire economy through bureaucratic coordination and formally independent cooperative corporate identities, typically including most other associates and group activities. It goes on to state that control of the justices is a notable mention, but not something that is that important as the characteristic traits of the totalitarian regime. With these six traits as a historical known from other autocratic regimes, and it goes on to state that the modern technology is mentioned as a significant condition for the invention of a totalitarian model, but the effect of monopoly has not been yet gathered, as there has not been the sufficient technology for complete control over people's behaviors.
Until now.
Until now. Which brings us to our important news article. Federal Vision for Healthcare IT, a Dystopian Paradise. This was published on December 31st by Ron Wyman of the, he is the Church Network, Crunch Network contributor, and is actually part of the healthcare regulatory and transactional team. And he uses an example to open his story saying, imagine you get a pleasant tone from your voice watch, which sends a text to you saying you're pregnant. Loretta is surprised. Conception was merely days before, but pregnancy is one of the many tests constantly checked by her website and household technology. And it goes on to say,
just think about
voice
that
conference
for a
with her doctor, I mean, from her home.
Let that sink in for a moment.
From a web-connected device that the insurance pays for. This story may seem like a fairly boring scheme in a Philip K. Dick short story, and it may also be a natural result of actions currently being undertaken by a powerful organization, the United States government, mostly unnoticed, with the hundreds with hidden inside the hundreds of pages of bureaucratic law, the federal agencies overseeing the healthcare information technology have laid out a vision not only for your future healthcare, but potentially everything you do.
See, healthcare was not about healthcare. It was about control of information, and there it is, it proves it.
And behavior, yeah. The implications of that vision are starting and at once both exciting and sobering. Taking into account recent technology and market trends, the government is actively supporting initiatives that could, in some cases, certainly will lead to the increased use of in-home wearable portable devices that monitor your activity 24 hours a day, that send information to your caregiver and your government. A learning health system
that
will take the knowledge gained from millions of patients and their genetics in their everyday health service, applying it to individual patients' specific conditions. They say that cutting-edge research will find unexpected causes and treatments for numerous diseases without any test subjects, using nothing but data already on hand. Patients directly accessing, controlling, and even correcting their medical records, no matter who the provider, and a Faustian bargain faced by each individual or society as a whole, in which one must choose between personal privacy and the full benefits of an available healthcare services.
Go figure.
That's a mark of the beast right there. Yeah, you have to make a choice. You
become
part of the collective, or you just exist if you're lucky.
It's
they go
coming.
On to state the government's role. They've adopted health IT. Health IT investment has required much more involvement through programs like Medicare, Medicaid. They say that 45% of the population will choose to become part of the system as it is incentivized. And coordinating the health information technology, change the rules regarding Medicare and Medicaid to provide incentives for a provider who is medical or meaningful use, which is electronic health record user. And the incentives can range monetary or other regulatory conditions based on...
Or rather than the... But it could go the other way. You could be ostracized. You can be kicked out of the system. That's a reward part, but the penalty part is equally problematic.
Yes, it is. The guidelines then promote increasing that a percentage using health IT to gain additional control of information about individuals' health and ultimately patients themselves. The most obvious opportunity to achieve control over a person's health outside of the clinical setting is through technology, the strategic plan says, which it does. And it goes on to say that using some form of mobile or wearable technology, federal agencies seek to expand the individual's to contribute to the electronic health information that is personally relevant and usable to their care provider so that it can both effectively be used in health planning and promoting electronic technology to track health and daily life. It's being brought to the reality through the meaningful use rules, and with more than a little vague definition, it says they can leverage in-home wearable devices and other mobile app technology to make it clear no one will get away.
It's convenient.
From their patient safety. Healthcare is and has always been about analyzing information.
No, it's about collecting data and controlling behavior.
Yes, it is.
And cutting off you for not compliant, for non-compliance. We're up against the top of the hour, folks. Look, we're going to come back with Joe. Finishing up, we're going to come back to finishing up the world in 2016. And folks, if you go to the page that extends the cover, because see, this is only half the cover. You go to the page 15, I believe it is. It's got the rest of the cover. Well, actually, it's on this one. You can only find one presidential candidate on the cover of this magazine. And you can see it right here. It's Hillary Clinton. What does that tell you? Get right back. Stay with us.
The This is the Global Star Radio Network.